Exit for Podcast is brought to you by the Cage Club Network. For all things comics, movies, media, music, and more, check out the Cage Club Network. That's cageclub.me. Everybody, and welcome back to All New, All Different, Uncanny X's for Podcast, the show where we take a look at the Uncanny X-Men comic book franchise as it continues its 1980s mutant mania domination of the market. I'm your host, Nico.
I'm Dylan.
And I'm Kyle.
I'm Jonah.
And we are here to talk about one of the most significant moments in the entirety of the X-Men ever. For real. So big. So special. But before we can get to that, I want to thank the Dawn of X team for coming out. This is one of those issues that I have so looked forward to covering with my team of best friends. And it's not that the show is ever an excuse to hang out with your best friends, but it's one of those things where we all love the same thing, and it's so great to get to share this together. Now, everybody here isn't just a part of the Dawn of X feed, where we talk about Jonathan Hickman's groundbreaking reimagining of the Uncanny X-Men in the pages of House of X and Powers of X. Everybody here has been a part of a different show at some point or another. Kyle, well, you've been appearing all over the network in incredibly cool special events like the Contest of Champions multi-parter we did, and you and I have a special little project cooking up that's going to be released this fall. You did the Champions with me, which was anything but championing. How does it feel to finally be part of a good book?
I am so excited to be here to kick off the start of something as great as New Mutants.
Absolutely. It's just one of those hallmarks of the X-Men. It's such a great time. Now, Dylan, you're the newest voice on the network, but you're far from the least prolific. You've been showing up on all sorts of shows like Contest of Champions, Uncanny X-Men, and you're going to be joining us going forward on shows like Dazzler and New Mutants. How did it feel to get to be part of this big launch in the X-verse and reread it?
I am excited because it's like I'm a full-fledged X-Man or a New Mutant now, so it's pretty exciting.
Oh, absolutely. You get your yellow and blue duds or yellow and black, or I guess if you want to be a Hellion, you could be in that, like, you know, like fuchsia and like purple shit, like that always looked kind of vaguely Magneto-y, so I could never figure out why the Hellions wore it. But, you know, you can do whatever it is you want, Mr. Warpath.
Yes.
Which, of course, that brings me to our other host, without whom I could not do this show. Jonah, I have been vamping getting to this moment in the series for so long, and I'm so excited to finally be here with you. And, you know, it's crazy because we just left the X-Men in space. So, how is your brain that we're all of a sudden just back on Earth having regular mutant misadventures?
Well, number one, I haven't had any complaints about my brain. Number two, I'm pretty sure the X-Men shouldn't even return to Earth. I don't think I'm ready to return to Earth. You know, there's nothing there for the X-Men. Everybody hates them, so why would they even go back? Why don't they just stay in space and have space marauding adventures, and Scott can actually have a decent relationship with his father, potentially, maybe? I don't know. I don't know if I can trust Corsair yet to be a good father, but...
I mean... Corsair does the best he can. He's just irrevocably damaged by galactic war.
Aren't we all, though?
The X-Men have had a pretty weird road of late, and it seems impossible that we're discussing Uncanny 166, yet somehow, everything the X-Men are going through is still radiating out of the events of the Dark Phoenix saga, which ended at issue 137. 138 saw Cyclops leave, starting the X-Men on a new journey where Kitty Pryde took front and center. Kitty's introduction led to other special events, like finding out more about Logan's past as he and Kurt journeyed to Canada to talk to Alpha Flight. We also saw the legendary Days of Future Past, which moved the X-Men's narrative forward considerably. Shortly after that, the X-Men battled Dr. Doom, who got real hot and bothered for Storm, who he then trapped in a statue, because I guess that turns him on. And before you knew it, the X-Men were fighting Magneto again at his new Bermuda Triangle base. Along the way, they picked up Carol Danvers, who had lost her memory and been abandoned by the Avengers to be an interdimensional, like, rape slave? Not crazy about it, Avengers. You did a real bad job. 151 and 152 saw the return of Emma Frost and her Massachusetts Academy, as if to say, don't forget, there are other schools that are interested in mutants. 153 focused on Kitty and Ileana developing a relationship, and Kitty's fairy tale, which, again, a reference to Dark Phoenix Saga in every way. And Kitty imagined herself getting a, oh god, Kitty imagined dragons. Kitty imagined herself getting a dragon named Lockheed. And the next thing you know, she gets a dragon named Lockheed. But I'm getting ahead of myself. In 153, the X-Men turn to space and first encounter the Brood alongside the Sidri and Deathbird. When the X-Men come home, Xavier's trapped in a psychic coma that leads the X-Men to try and clean up some of their bad PR with the help of Carol Danvers, who says goodbye to her old life as she faces off against Mystique one more time. In 159, a second Eastern European dude gets the boner for Storm, and Dracula wants to bang her. Weird. In 160, Ileana is forcibly aged by Belasco. You know, there's way too many lascivious, creepy dudes coming at young women in these stories now that I'm talking about it out loud.
It's gross.
It's much gross. Buh! So then, 161 to 166 is the landmark Brood saga, in which we get a flashback to Xavier meeting both Magneto and Gabrielle Makes Me Wanna Holler, as well as coming out of his coma. 162 is the very famous Wolverine versus the Brood issue. 163 sees Kitty do her second alien impression, before 164 gives us Carol Danvers as Binary, who, much like Jonah, sees very little reason to come back to Earth. The X-Mansion was blown up, not sure why they're desperate to come home. I digress. 165 sees the introduction of Paul Smith, and a three-page story inside of it from the point of view of Moira MacTaggert. Now, Moira, whatever you may think of her more recent appearances, was always a central focus of the X narrative, especially at this point in Chris Claremont's storytelling. She is sitting with Stevie Hunter and then immediately begins to, like, aggress at Xavier. I don't care how sad you are. Your PTSD isn't more important than putting kids in harm's way. Kind of. What did everybody think about that exchange between Moira and Xavier, where she sort of eggs him into reforming the X-Men?
It seemed kind of forced to me. It definitely felt like she was trying to manipulate Charles in this particular instance.
You know, that was Jonah's exact response in the Uncanny episode where we discussed this issue. He even made a comment that she was going for all kinds of low blows, like, you know, Proteus was my kid, but he could have been yours. Like, she was definitely not in the nice headspace she should be in here. She was going off a little bit more like Emma McTaggart instead of Moira Frost, if you know what I'm saying.
I do.
Dylan, did you have any reaction? Now, I know Jonah and I are, like, hardcore Moira obsessors, but you're someone who said that you didn't necessarily always resonate with her earlier stories. Did this one stand out for you in any way?
It slightly did. Like Kyle said, it seemed like she was trying to manipulate Xavier, and that seemed a little bit different than the Moira in previous issues. And I would say this was one of the few times where Moira did kind of seem interesting to me.
Now, Jonah, we read this as part of an interlude from a much larger narrative that ran roughly 7 issues, and here are these 3 pages that out of nowhere are just like, oh, by the way, let's make a new team. Looking back at these 3 pages, would you as a reader in the tail end of 1982, beginning of 1983, would those pages have made you want to run out and buy the New Mutants graphic novel?
Yes and no. I think I would be excited for a new team, and this would be a team that Chris created all by himself, basically. He didn't have help from Len Wein. He's kind of flying on his own right now. But I don't think Chris wrote it in the best way possible. I think in the New Mutants graphic novel, Moira here kind of makes a little more sense. She's kind of showing Charles tough love by saying, listen, I know you love the X-Men, but they're not more important than the dream that we both have right now. We put a lot of work into. You kind of have to snap out of it. That makes a little more sense than telling Charles, my dead baby could have been yours. By the way, we're not fucking again.
Yeah, that was...
you know?
That was a moment of Machine Gun Moira, as we like to call her. There's something really great about how everything kind of changes the minute you open the New Mutants graphic novel by Chris Claremont and Bob McLeod. Released in December of 82 or January of 83, kind of varies. The story isn't just different in terms of the character narrative provided, but the interiors have a very different look. The Marvel graphic novel line was painted and designed to be a slightly kind of higher quality to the art, bit of a bigger deal. It was presented in magazine-sized format, so the original original printing of this story was significantly larger than that of a normal comic book. Dylan, when you open this book and the art is totally different, you know, Xavier goes from looking like vaguely like your creepy uncle to like a pudding golem. Does the art being so different in this story affect how you read it?
I think it does. If I were to think about it coming out in graphic novel form and it being the next generation of X-Men, I think it was an amazing decision to put this in a graphic novel, because this might be some reader's first introduction to the X-Men or wanting to pick a starting point to start reading X-Men, and for it to be a new generation in the larger size and more painted, picturesque, non-comic-y feel is just a great idea, because it could make someone absolutely love comics that might not have liked them before.
I really get that, especially because one of the things that we just highlighted was how this whole story felt like this big rolling bout of thunder, that everything started propelling forward pretty much in giant-size X-Men, and Claremont really loved to gather steam with every step he took. That led to a lot of stories that frequently required having read previous issues, even though the market wasn't yet designed for that. Now, one of the things that I've noticed about an early Claremont story tends to be when he's launching something new, that the characters, the new characters, are pretty underdeveloped, but the story is really well thought. Here, I found the story a bit more generic, but the characters lit up the page for me. Kyle, you're somebody who, I love your dissection of character, and I love how you think about the characters interacting with the narrative. Were there any characters that right away leapt off the page for you? I know we discussed early on with Giant Size and Champions, no one did. But here, I felt like this was a different story. How about you?
Yeah, I immediately clicked with both Danielle Moonstar and Sam Guthrie. Danielle, she's this really strong, natural-born leader, and then you've got this goofy boy in the form of Sam, and he's naive, and he's adorable.
Yeah, it's a case of winningly naive. You root for him, even though he's, you know, hayseed. And that even elucidates a really interesting point. Now, Kyle, you grew up in a slightly more rural area, right?
I did.
So was that a part of your connection to Cannonball?
I don't think I'm really that kind of rural, but I can kind of understand what he's dealing with.
I really like that, you know, you're able to even say, no, this is such a specific character who's given such rich life that I can distinguish the kind of rural that we each come from. And that's an important element of Claremont's storytelling. Right off the bat with Giant Size X-Men, Len Wein sought to give the X-Men background, but more frequently than not, he just sort of put them in situations. It was so strange that the first page of Nightcrawler is him being chased by torch-wielding villagers, because yes, don't get me wrong, hated and feared, and Nightcrawler looks like a monster, blah, blah, blah. But Nightcrawler isn't like, people don't really chase Nightcrawler with torches all that often. So it didn't really feel like a natural story introduction. But here, we get a similar entrance from a creature looking not quite human. We get the introduction of the, if you've been reading classic X-Men with us, already introduced in a way that was kind of confusing, Rain Sinclair. Rain would go on to become Moira's ward, which essentially like foster kid, but not quite. Why not? And Rain is, man, she is such a unique character. Anytime the X-Men get close to religion, they tend to, you know, run the other way. But Rain runs full force toward religion in every story. Now, Dylan, you're someone who's told me that you're a Rain fan, and she's been through a lot of ups and downs. What is it about Rain here, this very fragile introduction, that had you drawn in?
I guess the best way for me to say that I love Rain is, like you said, she's so headstrong with her religion, because that's just how she was raised. It was basically, most likely, forced down her throat, so that's all she ever knew. And she stays strong to what she knew, and that was her religion and family. And it's really kind of funny that the way they introduced Nightcrawler and the way they introduced Rain or Wolfsbane, the creature one, is the one that's so religious. And I love Nightcrawler. I'm not as obsessed with him as certain other people on this show.
Cough, cough, Drona Crawler.
I think it's just how dedicated they are to their beliefs is why I really like Wolfsbane.
And that's really, I completely love that answer, because I never would have seen that, actually. I would have expected you to talk about how she's innocent and you want to protect her and root for, but no, like, the strength of her convictions and strong women is a really central theme of the New Mutes. The initial team of five people is three female heroes and two male heroes. The staff at the school initially consists of one male and two females. The New Mutants is overwhelmingly filled with strong women and, actually, racial minorities as well. Jonah, I know you'd commented that you couldn't help but notice that three of the New Mutants were not white, and that's phenomenal for 1983.
Yes, it is, and unfortunately, we're not still far away from certain stereotypes, looking at you, Birdo, but Danny and Karma set themselves apart of not falling victim of being stereotypes and kind of being their own characters. That's something I just noticed with Chris. I'm going to call him by his first name. We're best friends, and he's definitely a
friend
listener
of
this.
Friend of the pod.
But... friend of the pod, Chris Claremont. He tends to write women very well. Sometimes when they're a male, I feel like he doesn't know how to write them well.
Expression of strength that Claremont uses is very much in the mode of a straight white man in his time. Don't get me wrong. I think Claremont is one of the most progressive storytellers Marvel has or had. He has always been looking forward to the future of diversity with open eyes and an open heart. So I'm very positive on Claremont as a social justice warrior. That said, there are a few choice moments in this book that I really would like to point to. Now, the era of Uncanny X-Men that this takes place in is filled to the brim with all sorts of stories that deal with hardcore issues like race. We're very near God Loves, Man Kills, which is the height of hated and feared. Not to mention, New Mutants number 4, who's scaring Stevie, is famous for its confrontation of racism, whether you agree with the language used or not, which I personally think no. This story sees a football competitor attack Birdo for being black. Now, Dylan, you had some strong feelings about making sure that when people discuss Birdo, they discuss his heritage correctly for the sake of understanding the character.
Yeah, I, in many other forums, have discussed Sunspot with other people, and I always just want people to make sure, yes, Birdo is Brazilian, but that he is Afro-Brazilian. And just like in this graphic novel, it shows that he's getting attacked by a teammate because he is Afro-Brazilian. Person attacking him is Brazilian as well, but because he is Afro-Brazilian.
Yeah, he suffers. He suffers for just trying to exist. He's literally called an animal masquerading as a human. Ironically, that is the moment that his powers reveal themselves, and in an unfortunate, very ironic moment, he becomes very black and turns into Sunspot for what I'm assuming is the first time. This wouldn't necessarily be, oh, you know, he's this passionate lover and he's super violent. Okay, that's a little heavy-handed. But as much as I do love Danielle Moonstar, and she's one of my all-time favorite X characters, I am not in love with the fact that Claremont seems to only understand one Native American perspective, and that is, I hate all white people. Not to say that any Native American who has those feelings is wrong, nor is that to say that that is an unfair perspective. However, it seems reductive that in two X characters created or primarily written by Claremont, he kind of goes to the same well of tropes for them. I do really love Danny, and I love Danny's story, and I love every element of Danny's story, but I do notice that Danny Moonstar is a rather aggressive form of the same headstrong behavior we saw from John Proudstar. However, none of that holds a candle to the moment that Kyle and I flipped the fuck out over when we reread. Kyle, I had read this when I was like a teenager, like 16, and that's like 20-something years ago, and not quite, but you know. And you read this like several years ago, and I don't think either one of us remembered the really overt racism on the part of Xavier that is never called out.
Yeah. I feel super uncomfortable even talking about it when he refers to Xian as...
Yeah, I can do it if you want.
Yeah.
I'm Cuban. I have no problem. He refers to Xian as boat people, and I'm just beyond uncomfortable because there's really, as we discussed in our Contest of Champions episode with new host Mikey, who's joining us for our wonderful Alpha Flight feed, myself, Mikey, and Jonah will be covering Alpha Flight read through the end of John Byrne's tenure, Mikey said he wanted to find a way to discuss things that were problematic from his childhood and say, well, that's just how it was, but he didn't want to sound like he was encouraging the behavior. The reality there is, all you have to say is, now, I think it was wrong and I don't agree with it, but it's what it was. And we understand. But things like this, the language can feel bad to even repeat. And no one in the course of the book says to Xavier, I was kind of fucked up. He seems to just get away with it. And that does not make me feel terribly comfortable. We've circuitously discussed the characters a bit here, but I want to take a moment and just run through the team. One of the most significant members of the New Mutants, especially their early adventures, is Karma. Sian McCoy was introduced in Marvel Team-Up No. 100 by Chris Claremont and Frank Miller, which also featured that amazing Storm and Black Panther backup story, which we read like several months ago now. It was 2 full years before Karma reappeared in the pages of Marvel Comics. Karma's powers are possession. Okay. Then there's Danny Moonstar. She's a new character, and her powers are create your worst nightmare. Okay, well, then there's Rain, and other than the wolfing out and swiping at people, which I guess that's pretty obvious, she has tracking powers. Guys, why is everybody but Birdo and Cannonball on this team psychic? Somehow, everyone is one of the functions of psychic abilities. Seriously, I'm not kidding. If you had just put Xavier in an Iron Man suit, he could have done this whole story by himself.
Someone told Chris that he didn't have enough psychics on his team, and then he thought, well, okay, I'll just make everyone a psychic then.
That had been one of your points during the Contest of Champions, that it was unusual, especially by modern Marvel standards, that there would be so few psychics. And, you know, coming to think about the X-Men now, number one, most books have more than one psychic. Your psychic choices are, of course, the Holy Trinity of ex-divas. You have Jean, Emma, and Betsy. But then there's a rich wealth of secondary psychics to love. Characters like Karma, Danny, Quentin Quire, Rachel Summers. There's, well, frankly, anybody with the last name Summers.
The Cuckoos.
The Cuckoos, yeah. There's just so many terrific psychic characters to latch on to. Monet. And you know, Cable.
Technically Cable.
He's using his TK to hold his techno-organic mesh in place. And you know, that's just, I guess, when you're that hot, it's just your cross to bear, I guess. Cable's like one of the only metal dudes I'm like super into. Colossus is a little too whiny for me, but like, especially young Cable. So, the other two mutes are Cannonball and Sunspot. Now, each of them has a really unique limitation. Sunspot literally runs out of energy if he hasn't absorbed solar energy recently enough, which is kind of a play on Cyclops, the same way Wolfsbane is kind of a play on Wolverine. But Cannonball's power... I don't even think they get too far into it in this, but Cannonball's main limitation is that he has no accuracy. Cannonball's got aiming problems. I would not have wanted to be the guy to teach him piss standing up.
I think they do a pretty good job of describing that, how he hits everything that he's not supposed to.
Kyle, these powers, they're so tied to the idea of what the X-Men are, honestly. The manifestation of your greatest fears, not being able to control your own mind, transforming into two different kinds of monsters, an impenetrable field that you can't control. So much of this echoes what we're going to see forever throughout the pages of X-Men, but we haven't really seen yet. Was this dynamically different team, especially in the course of rereading, was this a breath of fresh X-Air, or do you actually see too many similarities with previous teams?
I think while they do have similar basic abilities, it's the way that they are presented that makes them more unique.
It's awesome that they are very similar, but I think it was the beginning of when it comes to X-Men and years later up to present time where there's a billion mutants. It was neat with having Danny and Karma both being psychics, but showing the different levels or intensities of controlling their abilities. Like we just mentioned, there's a billion psychics now. New Mutants was kind of the beginning of showing that there can be psychics that are completely different than Jean and Xavier.
Something I appreciate about this is they have similarities, whether it be limitations or what extent that they can do. Nobody feels like they're a replacement. Like Chris was told you can't write Wolverine, so Wolfsbane was supposed to be the Wolverine stand-in. She doesn't act anything like Wolverine. She feels like her own character, and I do appreciate that. We're getting introduced to 5 new characters as opposed to 5 carbon copies reskinned because he was told he wasn't allowed to play with them anymore.
Oh, I love that. Reskinned. That's a really great way to think about it because, yeah, these really do pop to life. Now, I've been a little negative on the story. And it's not because the story isn't strong, but it takes 15 pages out of roughly 45 for most of the New Mutants to be convocated together. Xavier seems to repeatedly forget that he's just agreed to train them a page or two earlier, and need to agree to it again. We get a slightly more in-character exchange between Xavier and Moira that very heavily echoes the exchange from 165. That said, the real crux of the plot is Donald Pierce of the Hellfire Club has returned and leads to the death of Roberto's girlfriend, Juliana, Danny Moonstar's grandfather, who is an old war buddy of Xavier's, and it's just kind of like, okay. It's just, the bad guy just killed some people, and we're just, okay,
sure.
It just feels very, didn't that kind of just happen? And other than Sam initially joining the Hellfire Club, and then immediately regretting it, the story plays out very similarly over and over again. A child is in danger in some way, Xavier or Moira reach out to them, and then they join. We see it with Rain, we see it with Karma, who is sent by Reed Richards, then we see it with Danny after the passing of her grandfather. We see it moments later with Birdo, and everybody just keeps being like, I'm only gonna stick with you guys for now, just till we stop Donald Pierce, which they then stop Donald Pierce the way they've stopped everyone all issue, with telepathy. In fact, when Karma isn't using her mind to control people, Xavier steps in, and then Karma takes over. The story is actually very redundant for 47 pages, but I think that's one of its strengths, by being redundant so that you don't need to focus on the story so much. As a matter of fact, other than he's strong, I don't know that Donald Pierce is very well defined in the context of this issue. The heart of this story is it's more important that these kids were called together than the why. Initially, we've made comparisons to Giant Size X-Men number 1 with this story through our notes and our green room discussions, and Giant Size X-Men number 1 is so defined by the Krakoan story. Oh man, I'm having fun now. So, it's so defined by the story of Krakoa that they don't really have time to develop the characters. Here, character development is of the utmost importance, and it's the primary function of the story. Donald Pierce is ultimately disposed of in a rather basic-ass way, and other than the surprise appearance by one of everybody's favorite psychics, I don't think there's too much in this story that can't be summed up in a couple of sentences. Kyle, what did you think about the nature of the narrative?
So, to me, I almost feel like the narrative wasn't important. I feel like this book was more about setting up the characters, teaching us who they're going to be, and just trying to build a rapport between the five of them.
I love that. Build a rapport between the five of them. You know, when I approach these books, I'm just so self-centered, and I immediately think about how I'm supposed to feel as a reader. But the story function here was more important to create a context for this team than it was for me to care about the team. Because if a story is told well, with strong characters, the audience is going to care anyway. I love that. Dylan, you're someone who's read, I think, every iteration of every Kid X team ever, as well as all of the adult ones. But the New Mutants were the first intentional team. Now, that's not to say that the original X-Men weren't teenagers, but the original X-Men were sort of blank canvases that would get personalities as needed. This was the first time that there was a focus on creating real-to-life kids that echoed the people reading the book. In terms of this team and comparing it to the many iterations that would follow, all of whom take their lead from this, what's one of the most standout elements that this team has that no one else does?
When it comes to this team, the way this graphic novel was written, it seemed a little bit more personable than maybe the original five or even the Giant Size, because it seems like we got a little bit more back history for these five. And yeah, the storyline and big bad, if you want to say, of this graphic novel for this team, yeah, maybe the story was similar or something that we had seen before, but we got to see it with a new team and how they would handle this. And it was actually just a team that it almost is written as if they were only put together within days or hours and knowing each other for days and hours. Like Kyle said, it was a great way to see these people quickly bond in similar fashions. Like Birdo had his girlfriend die and Danny had had her grandfather die, so they had that in common. And it was just a really well put together story.
I really think you guys are just bringing so many levels to this that I've never even considered. I really love all of this discussion. Jonah, one of the things that has been so terrific about examining this with you is while I read this as a kid, I read it as a kid so long ago, and not that you're a kid, but you're certainly closer in age to the characters of New Mutants than I am at this point. And I would love to know how this story holds up for you in a modern comic setting.
I think this comic is really interesting because I don't think the plot is as strong as other stories we have read, as I think is the consensus, but I think it's still full of pretty good details that Chris is really good at doing. But I think what this book excels at is being, and this is not in a bad way, generic enough for any teen to pick this up, even now, and to say, I can identify with one of the characters. And I think that's where it really hit the nail on the head, as opposed to something like Giant Size X-Men number one, where you can't say you saw yourself in a character yet because nobody really had a discernible personality because there wasn't time for it. They're written so well and so multidimensional in such a short amount of time that I think that anybody would be able to just, you know, be able to enjoy these characters.
Before Warpath Dylan was going to join the team as a regular contributor, he was going to be providing secondary segments like the following. While we ultimately decided we were going to put Dylan on the main team and run less of these segments, there has been so many fans reaching out asking for a little bit more information on Monet. So when I realized that this was still sitting in our back catalog, there was no way I could not run this. So here for you now is one of the first ever recorded segments by Dylan Warpath. We're going to be checking out a little bit about Monet.
Hey everyone, it is Warpath Dylan here, and this week I am here to give you a character spotlight on an X-Man that is very near and dear to my heart. That X-Man is Monet. She's also known as just the letter M as her code name. Her entire name is Monet Yvette Clarice Maria Therese St. Croix. Monet made her first appearance in 1994 during the all X-Men related comics crossover known as the Phalanx Covenant. During this crossover, an alien species had came to Earth and was taking out all mutant life. They had captured most of the main X-Men and then were going after the next generation of mutants. Monet was one of these next generation of mutants that had been kidnapped, and a short time later, the X-Men had prevailed and defeated the Phalanx, and Monet, along with a handful of other teenage mutants, became the team known as Generation X. Years after Generation X had started, we found out that the Monet that we had known for a handful of years was actually not Monet, but she was her two younger twin sisters, Nicole and Claudette. Nicole and Claudette had used some magical powers of their own to merge together and become their older sister, Monet. The reason they did this was because Monet was their father's favorite child, and Monet had gone missing years prior. The reason Monet had gone missing is because the three of them had an older brother, Marius, rather known as Implete. He had been traveling to other realms, and he had discovered one that he wanted Monet to help him rule. Monet has immense power, and he wanted to use that to his advantage, but Monet did not take up his offer. She did not want to join him. When she refused, he used his own magical powers to trap her into a body of another entity known as Penance. This was a body of a person who was mute and in razor-sharp skin. She couldn't touch anyone, she couldn't speak to anyone. But while Monet was trapped in this body, Implate, being a mutant vampire himself, was able to absorb energy out of her to gain Monet's strength and awesome power to fuel himself. Years later, the fake Monet was hurt incredibly during a battle with Sentinels, and this forced the two young Monet sisters to become unconscious, and they couldn't hold their power together to maintain their facade that they were Monet. They were separated during this battle from being merged with each other, revealing to the team that they were not Monet. Shortly in issues to come, it turned out that Monet was still in this body of this mutant known as Penance that was also with Generation X, but none of them knew anything about her. Soon, the twins were able to help Generation X free the real Monet. Since then, Monet has been a powerhouse of an X-Man. She's been on multiple teams, including the overseas team X Corporation. She then joined X-Factor Investigations. She then went on to join the X-Men in an official capacity. She, in a brief time, was the new White Queen for the Hellfire Club. And then she, in recent years, was a part of a team known as Weapon X, but also kind of known as X-Force as well. Monet is, as I mentioned, a powerhouse. She's known by everyone in the Marvel Universe as the perfect mutant. The reason she's known as the perfect mutant is because she has incredible power. Her list of abilities includes superhuman strength, supersonic flight, flight abilities, telekinesis, telepathy, accelerated healing, genius-level intellect, superhuman reflexes, coordination, vision, hearing, and she also has the ability to perceive mutant auras. Like I said, Monet is very near and dear to my heart. I absolutely love powerhouse characters, and Monet is a very complex character. The messed up origins as they are give her a little bit more depth than other characters, because writers throughout the years have had to flesh out that messed up origins story to make sense. And to me, she is one of the best characters. I hope you have all enjoyed this spotlight on one of my favorite characters. You can catch me on Instagram at Warpath_Dylan, and you can always find me in my Facebook group for X-Men that is called House of X. And for all those Monet fans out there, there is a Facebook group that is also called House of Monet. Thank you.
These characters mean the world to me, and these characters so represent idealized but flawed versions of who I wanted to be growing up. These heroes gave me hope, and they gave me people to aspire to that I recognized were not perfect, so I didn't lose sight of who I wanted to be. And I absolutely agree. I saw people in New Mutants that I saw in myself, and I cannot frigging wait to talk more about the New Mutants and their interactions with the X-Men. However, one final note before we go. I hope everybody appreciated that Claremont's incredibly long game in the form of Sage took its first big step toward what the fuckery when Tessa was revealed to, like, vaguely know Xavier. I mean, Kyle, somehow you've managed not to read any Sage for the most part. Dylan, we're obsessed with her. And poor Jonah just is like, who is this woman?
She just needs dialogue.
Oh man, Kyle, you've read so much X-Men. You've basically read the Claremont era, it's his initial era, before, you know, he comes back for Revolution in 100. Telling you that Tessa eventually becomes Sage.
What?
I mean, 20-year spoiler, right? It's just so ridiculous.
I'm so confused.
This isn't even her first appearance.
No, because, I mean, it's so fucking ridiculous. But tell me, Dylan, what special designation does Sage have?
She's the first X-Man.
Oh, she's the first X-Man, you say? Oh, Jesus. Oh, man, sometimes Claremont plays such a long game that it started before he was even involved. And on that note, guys, it has been so fucking incredible talking about the New Mutants graphic novel with you. And I am, like, ready to pick up my copies and keep reading so that we can talk about more of these adventures. But, Kyle, until you're in my secret project launches later this fall, where's everyone going to be able to find you online?
You can probably find me researching that secret project. But in the meantime, you can find me on both Twitter and Instagram at Drantis82.
And you recently posted a rather handsome photo while recording our very secret project, so I'm really excited to have that come out. Cough, cough, it's Thor. So, Dylan, Dylan, you have been such an amazing asset joining Kyle and Jonah and Kevo and everybody on the network, and I couldn't be more grateful. You bring in such knowledge and a great sense of community with your amazing Facebook group, House of X, as well as the number of other groups you moderate, co-moderate, and are a part of. Where can everybody find you online until you come back to the pages of X-Men?
Like Nico mentioned, you can find me on Facebook in my House of X Facebook group, but you can also find me on Instagram at Warpath_Dylan. That is Warpath_DYLAN.
And Jonah, amazing co-host, guy who helped me start this project, fellow I love so much. Other than next to me all of the time, including this year's NYCC, where can everybody find you online?
retconning that it was me actually the entire time as the first X-Men. Sorry, Sage. You can find me online on Twitter and Instagram at Jonah Rubino and at Jonah.Rubino. Nico, where can everybody find you?
You guys can find me trying to recover the pieces of Claremont's brain now that Jonah just blew it. Claremont didn't even know that he had written that Jonah was the first X-Man before Sage, which I think makes him her grand Sage. You guys can find me all over this, bad joke. You guys can find me all over this network on shows like
You're alone on that.
I know,
one.
I was out on that branch and then it snapped. So you guys can find me on Now and Again, where I talk about pop music with my childhood best friend Chris Podcast. It's a great dude, great show. Love being a part of it. You guys can find my music all over this network, doing themes for shows like Too Fast, Too Forever, as well as these shows that I am a part of. Not to mention Jonah's boyfriend, my husband, the amazing Kevo. And I have a show called HTML where we talk about movie franchises, dissecting them piece by piece. You guys can also find me on Instagram at NicoAction. All right, guys. Until we return to Gray Malkin Lane, we will see ya.
See ya.
Bye.
Bye.